thank you all for joining this Q&A session this morning. Sorry for the slight delay. We've had the highest number of attendees we've ever had, so we're expecting some tough questions. I hope you've all had an opportunity to watch our virtual results presentation. If you haven't and would like to, you can find the link on the webcast. As I said in the presentation, I'm incredibly proud of the way Legal & General has risen to the operational market challenges presented by COVID. I'm actually excited and enthused about our prospects in H2 and beyond, levelling up, build back better, the planning changes, all play to Legal & General's narrative. And people can see the importance of being an asset manager, but also increasingly an asset creator. As you've seen from the results, we've demonstrated that our balance sheet is robust, our operational earnings are resilient, and our strategy is highly relevant, probably more relevant than it's ever been. That's both to weather the storm of the health pandemic, but also to help build back better and investment-led growth. I'm here joined at Coleman Street by my colleagues, and we're ready and looking forward to answering your questions. As normal, try not to ask more than three sub-questions within your questions, but we'll give you some grace time. Thank you, and the first question is from Andy Sinclair.
Thanks, Nigel. I've got three questions, of course. First one, you've held the dividend flat today. Like, I can understand the backdrop, but it is a divergence from your policy of interims being 30% of the prior year. Can you tell us a little bit more about the rationale for that decision, given it only saved about £20 million? Secondly, within LGI, just wondered if you could give us a little bit more colour about the experience variances. How much was COVID-specific, how much attributable to each of the UK and the US? And my third question being on the fixed income portfolio, you've got a little bit more double B today than previously, though still only about 2% of the portfolio and clearly hasn't had too much of an impact on solvency given the capital beat. You gave a bit of colour in the presentation on some of this being assets under construction, but do you have a cap level in mind for which you'd like to keep sub-investment grades below, or does it just depend on the backdrop? That's my three questions.
Thank you, Andy. Those are more thought-provoking questions than we get from you usually. So I'll answer the first one. I'm going to ask Bernie to answer the second one if Jeff picks up the third one. The dividend was a very good discussion with our board, and really there were two options, either 0% or 7%, and we came down on 0%. We thought that was the right thing to do for the right reasons at the right time. It was a very measured response. It also gives us flexibility over the rest of the year because although we've been robust and resilient, you can't tell what's really going to happen with COVID. The science is very imprecise. We're delighted with our results. The point you make is a relevant one. You know, it was not much incremental cost from paying the extra amount of the dividend of near £20 million, as you said, and we could have easily afforded it. But we thought we had to be relevant to the times, and I think that's what we've done with the dividend decision, recognise that lots of people are going through difficult times, and although we've done incredibly well, we think we're rewarding shareholders fairly by paying the same dividend as last year and being aware of the wider societal issues that are going on right now. And actually, it is the right thing to do. Bernie?
Yeah, sure. So on the experience variances, we've given you, the biggest one, obviously, which is claims. We're here to pay out when tragedy strikes, and that's exactly what we're here to do in a pandemic. And so we have, we've seen a number of claims, particularly in the US, but also as some small amounts in our group protection business. It's 80 million overall from claims, which is the vast majority of the experience variances. It's about roughly a quarter in the UK, three quarters US sort of it would be where it is. And it's fair to say we've had about half of that already, and we've got half, another half is provisions, just slightly more than half is provisions. So we're hopeful that, yeah, we've already provided for claims coming through in the second half. Clearly, we don't know how things are going to pan out, so there's some uncertainty there, but we hope we've provided for enough there. Hopefully, that's the colour you're looking for, Andy.
Yeah, sure. And just on the fixed income portfolio, as you say, Andy, we've had good experience to date. There are a small number of downgrades to sub-investment grade, and there are some very good reasons for some of those in the direct investment portfolio. As I said in the presentation, we do anticipate on completion that those would upgrade again. We obviously would ultimately have a limit of concentration around this, but we look very much on a case-by-case basis. We will trade when we economically think it makes sense. We're never a forced seller. And, you know, we also are looking in a more a holistic sense of, well, what do double Bs mean going forward? Is there a different dynamic around that? And we will weigh that up against the economic, or almost non-economic, if you like, impact that it has on the Solvency II ratio versus what is the best thing for us to be doing. We have a trimmed slightly a couple of those that have downgraded. We thought that has made sense, and we'll continue to look at it, as I say, on a case-by-case basis. I think those credit meetings have gone to weekly now from daily, you know, so we constantly look at that and speak to the traders, speak to LGM around what makes sense to look at those assets.
Thank you, Andy. Just in terms of quantification from Bernie's answer, we provided about 44 million for H2 in LGI, and we hope that's a good number. But clearly, that given that we've already provided that, that will influence the level of profits, and therefore, but what Bernie was telling you was he's going to do much better in H2 than he's done in H1. And on the rating, obviously we have a lot of assets under construction, and then naturally upgrade when the construction's finished, and some of those are starting achieving practical completion in the next few weeks. So thank you. The next question, gosh, Andrew Green. So we're sticking with the ears to start with. Andrew.
Morning all. Yeah, three questions. Firstly, LGIM, at the full year, you dodged the question about whether you were sticking with the 8-10% growth rate. I just wonder whether that is your commitment and when that starts, because obviously it's a little bit behind this year. Secondly, on LGR, 81 billion portfolio, trying to grow the book by 8-10 billion a year in terms of, not grow the book, but grow new business. What kind of growth in cash profits does that allow you to achieve while maintaining a decent solvency position? And finally, you've talked about a 3.5 billion credit provision under IFRS. How does that provision play into Solvency II? And if you do get defaults in Solvency II, is there a provision sitting there which can be deployed, or will it hit the capital generation?
Okay, thanks, Andrew. I don't think we dodge questions, Andrew. I think that's a bit harsh to say we dodge questions.
Well, I think Michelle had broken leg, didn't she? Which was fair cop.
She's just about recovered from her broken leg, and she'll be joining us on the call. So I'll pass that to Alan in a second. I think what we've said was that we would update you on a lot of strategic issues at the November Capital Markets Day, and that really hasn't changed. Really, in the first half of the year, we saw good revenue growth from LGIM, and assets went up as well, but costs went up by a higher percentage, and so the rate of growth of profits is a lowish number, but it's unusual at the moment to get growth and profits in the fund management industry. And again, the robustness and resilience of the business has shone through. Michelle, would you like to add to that?
It's a great question, Andrew. As I said, we'll definitely come back to this at the Capital Markets Day. I didn't deliberately make that promise. I would just echo what Nigel has said. It is a tough environment for asset managers. We talk about looking to deliver positive net flows as a percentage of opening AUM. That's something I think that we will continue to talk about. And then clearly there's a market return that goes with that. I would love to come back to this at the Capital Markets Day.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Jeff, can you answer questions 2 and 3?
Yeah, sure. to some extent, the second question would also be a core element of our Capital Markets Day, because clearly, the growth we achieve on LGR will be a big driver of what's possible. We've talked before about this sustainable portfolio, and at that level of 8 to 10 billion per annum, the capital base deals with that and the business becomes self-financing, you still get significant growth, as you say, in cash earnings that comes from that. There's a lot of surplus thrown off the back book, prudence, whether that be on an IFRS basis or Solvency II. And we'd be confident of continuing to deliver growth of the sort of scale that we've seen to date. We'll be more specific on around that. Does it alter by plus or minus a few percent as we move to a more steady state on LGR, which will then depend what other businesses are doing and how much growth we get in the US. The 3.5 billion on the credit default reserve, yes, that's the IFRS basis. Interestingly, there's almost as much embedded in the best estimate in Solvency II, because the fundamental spread is a deduction over 50 basis points, and that's slightly less, in fact, than we get hold for IFRS to get to the 3.5 billion. So even in your base balance sheet, you have prudence of 3.5 billion or so in a similar way in Solvency II, and then you hold capital on top of that. There isn't the same loss absorbency because they're not seen as margins. But, of course, unless you get a jump to default from a higher rated asset, then this would tend to be an asset that is on its way down, probably being downgraded. We'll do something about trading it. At the point it would default, we'd naturally be replacing that, or probably already have replaced in the portfolio with a higher rated asset. So the marginal impact on the Solvency II balance sheet would therefore be reduced. Nigel.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. We're obviously incredibly pleased with the performance of the people within both LGR divisions under these really extraordinary times. They produce fantastic sales numbers. And just looking at H2 again, why are we positive about H2? LGR has already completed nearly 700 million of PRT deals and has 2.7 billion in exclusives and a pipeline of 18 billion just in the UK alone. And people have really risen to the challenges across all of the divisions of LNG and delivered a great outcome for H1, and we're very positive about H2. The next question, it's another A. It's Andrew Baker, and look forward to a B or a C coming up in the future.
Hi, Nigel. Thank you guys for taking my questions. Three again, keeping with the theme. So the first, I guess just a quick one, just returning to the dividend. Appreciate that it's flat year on year and the answer that you gave there. Can I assume there's no change to your underlying progressive dividend policy? And then second, on the COVID-19 impact. So specifically, as I look at LGR, had a positive 32 million impact. LGI, the negative 80 that you've talked about, 44 million of which was from future claims. Should we expect greater positive variance from LGR in H2? I guess what I'm getting at is you're overweight longevity, but it seems like so far at least mortality's had a larger impact on your results. And then the third one's on the bulk annuity pipeline. So you disclosed in June 25 billion. There's 18 today, but I think that is UK only. So what is your overall bulk annuity pipeline? Is it materially different to that 25 billion that was announced previously? Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, on the dividend, the message we're trying to give is we thought we were being appropriate in these times with 0%. And if you'd listened to the brilliant virtual presentation that Jeff and I have given, we've said and reiterated that there's no change to our progressive dividend policy. On the LGR questions, I'm going to pass you over to Laura Mason, who can talk both about the pipeline and the COVID impact, and maybe the longer-term impact on mortality that we're seeing.
Yep. Thank you, Andrew. I mean, on the mortality, we're continuing to monitor this on a regular weekly basis in terms of the impact on COVID, as we do with many other impacts on mortality. As you may be aware, recently, actually, the impacts of mortality have been less than usual over the last, taking the average over the last 5 years and comparing to mortality in the UK. So we're just continuing to monitor. In terms of your question on the pipeline, yes, you're quite right. The 25 billion is referring to the UK. I think that was Hyman's Robertson's estimates, and that's something that we consider about right, given what we can see in both the wider market pipeline and our Elgin pipeline. The US market is picking up. It's been a good market over the first half of the year. Q4 is always a busy time in the US, and there are certainly some larger deals coming through, larger than we'd expected, actually, in the US, which isn't included in the 25 billion. Thank you. Back to you, Nigel.
Yeah, in big picture terms, last year was a record year, and this year will be probably the second best year ever. You know, we expect to get our normal market share in the UK and gradually keep edging up in a very measured way in the United States. And we're now moving away, excitedness, moving away from the ears, and John Hocking's next up to ask a question.
Thanks, Nigel. Morning, everyone. I've got three questions, please. Firstly, on the mortality within LGR, Jeff on the presentation mentioned the 200 million guidance for the CMI18. Is it reasonable to assume that given there's been an acceleration in the first half, that the net number is likely to be lower than that? That's the first question. Second question on new business strain. It was very low in the first half. Should we assume that normalizes somewhat in the second half? And then the final question on LGC, below the line, in the release, I think it mentions that the majority of the below the line write down is on the equity portfolio and not on the two retail assets. But could you give some idea of the split there, please? Thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to ask Jeff first and then maybe Laura to back up the answers to the first two questions, and I'll pass the third one on to Carrigan, who can talk not just about, can talk in general about the investment markets in the UK for the assets in his portfolio.
Yeah, John, on the LGR mortality, certainly the 200 million I gave, that was simply for moving to CMI 18 for year-end reserving. That's irrespective of COVID impacts, et cetera, within the year. That would be more in the base table. So, now that's where we're looking today. We are at the same time looking at the medium to long-term impacts of COVID and whether there will be a change of funding, whether there'll be changes in what flu does because people wash their hands, are more conscious, et cetera. And there's numerous other effects. You know, who knows where unemployment might go, delays in treatment around cancer. We will also feed that into our view, but those are independent of first half experience. You saw the 32 come through in LGR, that was the experience to date around COVID that has already been allowed for. So there is no offset between the two. No new business strain was around 4%. We continue to be very efficient. It was a slightly longer duration business, deferred business. So, you know, we work harder to keep the strain down on that. And so we'd be reasonably positive for the second half around new business strain. No reason to think it would be fundamentally different. As ever, it will depend if there's one or two lumpy schemes with slightly different features, then that can change. But, you know, it's broadly in line with where we expect it to be ongoing.
I think what Jeff said is 4% for the the H2 as well. Thank you, John, for your question. We'll now move on to...
Kerrigan.
Oh, sorry, Kerrigan. Gosh.
The below-the-line LDC comments, I mean, as you quite rightly pointed out, the majority of the impact is public market equities. Then we mentioned a couple of our retail assets, and then there's some noise there. Probably I'd describe that as noise in terms of some other assets there. But those are the main two themes. To be helpful, just trying to do the figures in my head, I think it's roughly 55-60% of that would be the public market equities. And then in terms of the two retail assets, so we talk about Bracknell, Lexicon, and the Springs at Leeds Thorpe Park, really as the ones the independent valuations came in lower for those. I mean, again, as we'd expect, and obviously in context, we have a just over $3 billion direct investment portfolio. Less than 10% of that is in these two retail assets. Yes, they are more experience and destination focused modern retail, but they've had as we all know, a very short, sharp impact that's exacerbated the ongoing trend in retail that we're seeing. So we've taken a sensible valuation on those, we think.
Thank you, Kerrigan. We will now move on to Oliver.
Good morning. I knew having a name at the end of the alphabet never helped. So three questions. First of all, the capital requirements pushed up by $1.2 billion in the first half. I mean, okay, obvious reasons behind that, but I'm just sort of wondering what can you envisage from a market perspective or indeed any other perspective that brings that capital requirement down anytime soon? And sort of, you know, I guess I'm looking for a sort of breakdown of how much of that was caused by rating downgrades and so on. Second question is the flows within LGIM appeared to drop away quite sharply in June from $11.2 billion at the end of May to $6.2 billion. Is that the US business that you're talking about? And if so, what's the outlook for that particular segment? And then the third question is a bit of a sort of simple question, but Nigel, you talk about a similar second half performance in terms of operating profit. Are you talking here the sort of underlying $107.5 million in the second half as being the aim?
Okay. Jeff takes the first question. I'll take the second one and the third.
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's two different things. I think there you're talking that obviously the SCR increased and, you know, that. What does that do on coverage ratio? We're very happy with 173. There's different things we can do to improve coverage ratio versus SCR falling. Clearly, a big impact in that SCR growth is the fall in interest rates. And everyone will have their view on where the yield curve is going. But, you know, we won't be, you know, relying on it increasing anytime soon. And we'll be well set up, by the way. Those of you that have got to our sensitivities will see that we're now slightly less sensitive to rates, which is helpful. Obviously, the recovery in equity markets and the other LGC investments that Kerrigan talked about would increase own funds, increase the ratio, and in particular spreads as well moving. So some of that impact will also have been the dispersion that I talked about in my presentation, where, you know, if we see those double B assets in particular coming back in over time, that again flows through. There hasn't really been a material impact from any credit downgrade, migration, et cetera. That hasn't been an impact. It's really those movements, as I talked about. We continue to have management actions available. We see the longevity releases would increase our solvency position. So very comfortable where we are and ongoing being able to use capital to write new business versus managing the overall position.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. On Elgin's assets, we had one very large outflow from one specific client of about $6 billion. They're a very large client of ours, and they simply took some of the assets in-house. We'd been discussing it with them for a very long period of time to make sure the transition worked well, and it was a pretty low-fee mandate. I think the second part of your question, I think, is a fair one, that in the US, we had net outflows, which we've had an amazing track record for a number of years. And again, that was just really because of various trigger points in certain mandates where they were switching their assets out of our business and into others because of the trigger points in the mandates. It wasn't part of natural and long-term outflow. And, you know, we're very pleased at a macro level that we had 6 billion of inflows in the first half of the year. In terms of similar, in the first half, I would say we had a similar level of profits to last year's first half. We were down 2%, but I think that's fair to call that similar. In the second half of the year, I think we've guided to the fact that we expect LGI to do better. I think Kerrigan's just articulated why LGC should do a little bit better. And we expect the other three divisions to continue on the course that they've been on in the first half of the year. And therefore, that's, you know, how we think of similar in that context. So thank you. We're now going to move back on to the A's, having briefly disappeared from the A's. Ashik, can you come forward next with your question or questions?
Yeah, thank you, Nigel, and good morning, everyone. So just a couple of questions. First of all, can we get some clarity on your debt leverage capacity? You have raised about £1 billion of debt this year. How much more debt you can issue, be it to capture the growth or be it to absorb macro shock? So that would be the first one. The second one is, like, just going back to Oliver's question about operating profit. I mean, clearly you reported only 2% drop, but then there was a big, about 200 million, 230 million of positive one-off in operating profit from assumption changes and some non-cash items. So how should we think about that number? I mean, how much of that number should be recurring in future? How much that should not be? Because there is a material difference. I mean, 585 is a report, 720 is a reported operating profit in annuities, but then 200, 220 could be, say, one-off non-cash items or model changes. So just trying to get a bit of sense of how much we should start baking in on an ongoing basis. And third would be, again, going back on dividend, I'm sure, like, you have discussed that earlier as well, but how should we think about the full year dividend? It could be a decision that I'm pretty sure you'll make at the end of the year, but any thoughts on full year dividends at the moment? Thank you.
First two questions, and I'll take the third question.
Yeah. Oh, excuse me. Sorry. Yes. On debt leverage, certainly one of the positives, if you like, have come out of the market volatility is a lot greater interaction with rating agencies. We've been talking to them a lot to help them understand our balance sheet and the movements. Clearly, we're talking around the leverage ratios. Generally, the RT1 was positive for Moody's and Fitch and others. So it was a good conversation with S&P. We've looked at those. We continue to deliver and grow our balance sheet, which gives us the headroom. We potentially have expensive debt next year that we will consider and whether that would be kept on the balance sheet. So at that point, we would certainly have more headroom. And within RT1, on a pure metrics basis, there is plenty of headroom. So we're very conscious of the rating agency metrics. Some have improved. Some we're getting closer to a sort of the AA limit. But we constantly improve that metric as the balance sheet grows. And all parties are comfortable on that. So we're happy we have enough headroom to manage that on an ongoing basis. On the second one, you don't quite recognize the number you talk about. Clearly, there was a release in LGR. But generally, this is sort of ongoing management of the bases. As Tim likes to say, we have lots of simplifications in our modeling that over time they become more material. They always set up, we hope, on a prudent basis, given their simplification. And we get to these on a list, and we slowly update them. Luckily, they're ongoing basis. They're positive because that's the way they're set up. And so there's an underlying level of maintenance of your methodology and assumptions that leads to these on an ongoing basis, I would say, as you've seen in our results over many years. It's not that there's suddenly a dip away from them.
Thank you. And the Tim that he was referring to is Tim Steadman. Please call him up with any really, really difficult questions afterwards. On the dividend, we think zero is just the right signal at this time. You know, it's an appropriate signal, not an inappropriate signal for us to make. It's a very measured one. It gives us flexibility around it. It's meant to, you know, demonstrate our long-term commitment to a progressive dividend policy, which we're not changing away from. And we thought zero was the best way of signaling that, given all of the circumstances that exist right now. Okay, thank you. We're going to move on to another A. Abid, please.
Oh, hi, morning. Thanks for taking my questions. I've also got three questions. The first one is coming back, actually, just following on from a previous question on mortality. I'm not quite clear on the mortality release, the size of the release on the annuity business and LGR versus the negative on LGI, and the quantum seems odd given this, the annuity book is much larger. So the question really is, I mean, is it just a case that you're being really conservative on the annuity book? And I'm just sort of thinking about stats from the ONS. They're suggesting that deaths so far this year are in the UK are about 50% above the past 5-year average. So just any more additional color on that would be helpful. And then the second question is on lower interest rates. Could you just share your thoughts on, if we do start to see the interest rates lower from here? I mean, I know, there's not much room to go to zero, but potentially get lower or even negative from here. How does that impact the affordability and demand for PRT business? And then the final question is on super funds. And I think you've said in the past that super funds are complementary to you, and indeed I think the legislation that's come out requires them to offload the business to insurers before they can extract any earnings, any profits. So from that sense, it clearly is complementary. But I also recall that there were plans that you may be setting up under a similar structure under the pensions regulation to benefit from the lower capital position there. And I'm just wondering if you can update us on your thoughts there, please.
Okay, if Jeff just goes through the structure of the releases for LGR and LGI, and then I'm going to ask Laura to comment on the PRT affordability and other questions. But I'm also going to ask Chris to comment on that for his business, as both for the individual annuities at lifetime mortgages. Indeed, if you want to make some passing comments on your digital care business, that would be great to hear.
And we can offline get people through the dynamics of what leads to this for the deaths that you see. But a very basic level, of course, don't forget you might be paying out £500,000 or £1 million for a death claim, whereas on an annuity, the reserve that you would be holding would be maybe a multiple of 12, 14 times the actual annuity per annum, and so you wouldn't necessarily get to the same sort of quantum, even if it was the same lives, if you like. Clearly, we did see a lot more older deaths in the population, but that's very much what's reflected there. We tried to reflect the COVID deaths in the period in what we've done for the annuity release. And we, as I say, we could explain the dynamics on that and what that leads to, but it's 32 is very clearly the answer, LGR. We don't believe we've been prudent conservative either way on that. We believe that's what our data is telling us for the COVID deaths in the period. We have paid out and put IBNR away for the group life business, in particular in the UK and the US mortality business, as Bernie talked about. And then we do believe we've been prudent in setting aside £44 million for the second half on the mortality claims, in particular focus at what the uncertainty in the US may lead to.
Thank you. And on the impact of lower rates, I mean, most of the clients in our pipeline have been preparing for buyout or buy-in for a long period of time, and we'll have relatively sophisticated LGI programs in place, which means they've been relatively immune to rates move in terms of their de-risking journey. And I think just sort of noting that a lot of our pipeline this year has been for buyouts, which tend to be longer durations. and we've seen no real change to that pipeline, even due to the recent move. I'll just quickly comment on super funds before handing over to Chris on the rates question for his business. You're quite right to point out that the guidance has been helpful to us, and we'll wait to see how, you know, it is only guidance at the moment. We continue to work through a number of different solutions within L&D that sort of will be directly competing with those super funds, our ISS and ACP products, which will be sort of directly competing and have the added benefit of being insurance contracts too. But as you say, it's definitely complementary in terms of what the guidance has come out with. But we will be continuing to work under the insurance regulation in the short to medium term, that's for sure. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Laura. Yes, we saw quite a brief drop in annuity sales, individual annuity sales earlier in the year, but it came back quite quickly. I think on the one hand, people are having mixed thoughts about whether this is a good time or a bad time to retire. In fact, we've seen volumes come back quite strongly. And in a way, this has kind of proved our case. If you're comparing an annuity with a drawdown product for most normal people, they've now had a lesson in what happens when you're invested in the equity market and see your pension funds drop. So I think in the long run, that will be really supportive for the product. And remember, there's a sort of secular increase at the moment in numbers of people reaching age 65 each year, which is going to go up from about 700,000 this year to about 900,000 by the end of the decade. So that's a sort of a good long-term growth driver for us. Lifetime mortgages was very slow in Q2 in terms of applications, and that would have been felt across the market, and probably we'll see that coming through in completions in Q3. But in fact, we've also seen a big bounce back there with the reopening of the housing market, and applications in July were back where they were in February, which is a positive sign for us going forward. And Nigel mentioned care, and obviously care is a huge issue for lots of people and our customers. We're doing more work digitally on our website and other channels to help people understand, find and fund the care that they need for themselves and their loved ones. We've made some good investments in recent years in companies like CareSourcer and Current Health, who are really coming into their own now in this sort of crisis and helping both individuals and society to help fix the care conundrum, so to speak, Nigel.
Thanks, guys. On individual annuity sales, I think that's another one that we can put in the bucket, similar and resilient. We would expect sales this year to be similar to last year, given the current trend that Chris and Emma and the team are seeing. We'd now like to hand over to Don to ask his question.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Great.
Very
hello.
Loud.
Thank you so much. Well, I'll whisper. Thank you for taking my questions. A lot of them have been answered already, but I still have three, if that's all right. Laura, you spoke a bit about the impact of rates, or the lack of impact of rates on demand from your customers. At the same time, lower rates makes it, you know, more capital intensive to write bulk annuities. Is that impacting the way that you're thinking about pricing and capacity? And I suppose notwithstanding that, I noticed that your Solvency II margins have improved really strongly, I mean, from 7.8 to 10.6, clearly getting a lot more bang for buck for your capital deployment this period. I assume that's to do with the fact that these are buyouts and so longer duration. Is that right? And so, you know, should we expect that to sort of normalise? Just one more question on bulks. So, Nigel, as you indicated, you know, the 675 done in July plus the 2.7 in exclusive, I mean, that suggests actually 3.4 already sort of, you know, good line of sight. Is this going to be a normal year then for bulks? You know, would it be normal? Would it be reasonable to expect sort of 8 to 10 billion for the year? And then final question, you've got an awful lot of cash. You raised a billion of, I mean, cash, not capital. You raised a billion of cash through debt. I notice you've got, I think, about 1.8 billion more cash on the shareholder account than you did at the end of the year. I mean, if you put that to work in LDC and into direct investments, I mean, that would clearly be very accretive. I recognize you can't deploy that all in one go, but does this give you the firepower to accelerate your allocations to direct investments and to grow LDC? Thank you.
And thank you for those questions. You sound like me at the management meetings. You know, why are we not going to do that? So I'm going to be very interested in my colleagues' answers here. Kerrigan can answer the question as why he's been lazy in deploying the capital and earning better returns for shareholders. And Laura can tell us why we're going to get a similar performance year over year in the PRT business.
I thought you would pick up on the increase in Solvency II new business value. I mean, I think the first two bits of your question are quite linked in terms of the rates and the 10%. I mean, as well as what Jeff talked about and you alluded to, yes, we have been seeing longer duration buyouts in the market, which again sort of plays well to the, or is evidence really that these schemes are very well hedged and are able to execute in these types of market environments. As well as being slightly long duration, we have been able to work with the market and invest in assets, particularly in March and April, at very good values in the credit markets, which helped both pricing from customers' perspective and our metrics. And I think it's those two combinations that really give you the sort of answer of both your strain and your value. And just picking up again on the 8 to 10 billion, yes, we do. You know, we think the pipeline, we've talked about a little bit about the pipeline already. We think the UK will be about 25 billion. The US is some really large deals coming through in the US. And as you know, Dom, we won't be necessarily playing on those large deals for those large deals, but we will hopefully give us some room for the slightly smaller deals. We were fifth in terms of total sales in the US in Q1 and expect to be fairly similar in half one. So definitely the 8 to 10 billion guidance certainly still stands. Over to you, Kerrigan.
Just on the point about cash, I mean, just in terms of balance, of course, we remain enthused by our strategy, and I'll just talk about that in a few minutes. But of course, we're thoughtful in the current environment. So just in terms of the strategy, housing, future cities, SME investing, we think those are all the right areas. On housing, it's everything, as you recall, but for everything by tenure, houses to sell, houses to rent, everything by affordability and also by life stage. We think strategically that's a long-term positive, and of course we'll be investing more there, but thoughtful as we go through the second half of the year. Similarly, future cities, all those themes remain of science and technology focused real estate, things like data centers and that much-needed urban generation, and of course we've continued to invest partly in that, as Nigel's mentioned on the video in Sheffield over the lockdown period. So we remain enthused by that strategy, of course, thoughtful again, and yet again, SME investing. We know there'll be a huge need for equity equity and debt in portfolios of SMEs. So again, we think we're on the right strategy there, but again, thoughtful. So that's probably the colour that I want to give you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. It was good of you to highlight the improvement in margin in LGR, but to give Bernie some credit, which we infrequently do on these calls, we saw new business value for his business go up by 19% year over year in the first half. And the margin got up from 7.6 to 9.4%, which is really as a result of all the, you know, the digital initiatives that Bernie and the team have executed actually brilliantly well in both the UK and the US. We'll now pass on to Stephen.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking the question. I only had one question, actually. It was on your credit migration sensitivity. Now, that's nearly doubled year to date from 800 million to 1.5 billion impact, but your credit portfolio hasn't really doubled in size in the first half of this year. Can you tell me exactly what's going on and why your credit migration sensitivity has increased so massively despite you know, still only applying a 20% downgrade to your portfolio, and your ratings don't seem to have moved that much over the 6 months either. Thanks.
Reasonably simple one. It's simply that the spreads are wider on the BB assets in particular. The biggest impact of that is that we assume, this isn't what we actually do all the time, but what we assume in the model is that as a BBB is downgraded to BB, that we sell it and rebalance. We do that across the whole portfolio, but that's where you get the most material impact, because the starting point of the BB spreads is so much wider than it was at year end. When you simply do the maths and say, okay, the same amounts have downgraded, you're selling them at a bigger loss, then that flows through in the sensitivity. So it's just the maths that flows through on that because of your starting point of spread.
On a personal level, I've never agreed with this methodology, as you can imagine, but my actuarial colleagues tell me I'm wrong. And it's extraordinarily prudent given, you know, our 20-year track record of what has happened under Simon's leadership, Kerrigan's leadership, and Laura's leadership of the business. We've had nothing like this. This is the real outcome. Can we now pass on to Trevor, please? We've got time for two more questions, actually. So, Trevor, can you be one of those last two?
Yeah, I can try. I can try, Nigel, if you like. Actually, they were quite straightforward,
really. You are
trying.
We're always trying, but...
Yeah, well, it's good to see your banter and enthusiasm has not waned in this period, Nigel. Right, first question. You referenced in your descriptions earlier on the cross-border, or I call it cross-border, the US/UK PRT deal with Market. I wondered if you might want to talk a little bit more about the potential that may have to do these kind of deals when you're the only player in town, really, as far as I can see, for a US-UK deal. The second thing really was just relating to LGC. Given the economy will need more investment capital than ever before, I suspect, in the next year or two, I wonder whether there won't actually be more opportunity for you to direct money towards direct investments within LGC than you've already targeted, because it does seem to me there's going to be lots of demand for your capital and probably some reasonable returns on offer.
Trevor, I absolutely agree with your second question, but I'm going to get Kerrigan to answer it in more detail. And if Laura, could you pick up the first one?
Thanks for noticing that one. And something that we're really quite excited about, as you say, Trevor, we're the only direct PRT writer at the moment that... operate both in the UK and US, and there are a number of global multinationals who are clients of both Elgin and Elgin A, and we are working on a pipeline at the moment where we'll be hoping to execute more of these types of transactions simultaneously in the UK and US. So something that's pretty exciting for us.
Yep. A few years ago where we ended up winning the UK leg and not the US leg, in part because of brand recognition in the United States. But our brand recognition now is way higher today in America, thanks to all the good work of our various US teams. Kerrigan?
Great, Trevor. Couldn't agree with you more in terms of the opportunities or the themes of build back better, a green economy with our clean energy assets. And then, of course, things like affordable housing or rental more broadly. These are all areas that will need new investments, that talk about shovel-ready projects across the country. Nigel's phrases from a decade ago. These are all things that are reality now, and we're absolutely excited by the opportunities there.
Thank you.
Do you think that might imply, Kerrigan, that you're... Oh, no, sorry, Nigel, carry on.
No, go on, Trevor.
No, I was just thinking whether it implies that your targeted level might be a little bit low, or maybe that's something you're going to address in your CMD in November.
Yeah,
I agree.
Nigel's agreeing with you, Trevor, the statement that we gave with the 5 billion, up to 5 billion, 8 to 10%, of course, we continue to think about that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Trevor, for your continued enthusiasm and energy towards the sector. And thank you to everyone for dialing in for this call and your questions. It was good to see the variety sometimes. First time we didn't get three questions off everyone. I think there were a couple of twos and one. And we really value and appreciate your continued interest and support in Legal & General. I mean, what we've tried to demonstrate, I think what we have demonstrated, is that Legal & General is robust and resilient, and its strategy and business model are the most relevant that it's ever been. And we are optimistic, ambitious, and realistic about the future. We look forward to meeting with many of our investors who are on this call in the next few weeks, and to updating you all at our capital markets event on the 12th of November. So be safe, be healthy, both yourself and your families, and we look forward to seeing some of you physically in person as you come to the Ghost Town, which is the City of London. So take care. Bye.